Hello and welcome to Rocket Talk. I'm Justin Landon, and I think we've got a real humdinger of a show tonight. This is not unusual for the show, but my guests are a lot smarter than me. I have Amal El-Motar. She's a Canadian author and blogger. She's won several awards for her poetry and was nominated for the Nebula in 2011 for her short story, The Green Book. In addition to her copious fiction credits, her nonfiction work can be found at Tor.com, NPR, and very soon, Lightspeed Magazine. Welcome, Amal.
Hello.
And my other guest is Natalie Lurs. She blogs at pretty-terrible.com, her own personal blog and playground. In the past, she was senior SFF reviewer for RT Book Reviews, and she's one of the most fearless people on the interwebs. Welcome, Natalie.
Hello.
So, Natalie, you just recently relaunched your own blog. What's going on?
Well, I felt like there was a little bit of mission creep since I wasn't really reviewing books anymore, so it didn't make sense to have reviews in the URL, and I just wanted a change.
I like calling it pretty-terrible.com because...
Well, the URL without the hyphen was taken by somebody who's not using it, and I hate them.
Oh, I hate when that happens.
I know, it's the worst. So.
It's like they're not even actually squatting on the domain for, you know, illicit purposes. They just forgot that they had a blog.
There's nothing there. I'm like going, I hate you. And if I contact you, you'll be like, yes, I want $10 million.
Yeah, so I recently closed down my own blog, and so I am going to put up another site. I was going to just do my name.com. Turns out many permutations of my name are taken. I don't have a particularly unique name. It's not a common name, but it's not unique either. And so, Amal, however, your website is fantastic. It is yourname.com, which is great.
It is. It is myname.com. I don't have that same problem, mysteriously, of mine being too taken. Although I will say, after a lifetime of having people assume that Amal is a man's name, I no longer have that problem because of Amal Alameddine, who is married to that guy, that actor. Who is he?
George Clooney.
That one.
That guy who was on The Facts of Life.
That one, yeah. He was in, like, Three Kings, I think, or something. Anyways, she, like, you know, super high-achieving, high-flying international lawyer lady, she's married to that guy now. But anyway, because of her and her being in the news all the time, now people know that Amal's also a woman's name, and that's very exciting to me. But also really weird, because now people are using my name all over the place, and it's, like, not me. So, yeah.
Congratulations on your Lightspeed column.
Thank you so much. My first one is in March, going to focus on three Aqueduct Press titles that were just phenomenal and blew me away. They're the three most recent ones in their Conversation Pieces series. So it's The Haunted Girl by Lisa Bradley, Elysium by Jen Brissett, and Ghost Signs by Sonia Taafe. All three are just, like, absolutely superb, and I was really chuffed that all three together, they make this really great theme around ghosts and hauntings and memory and stuff like that. So I'm well pleased. I'm well pleased at the thematic unity of my first Lightspeed column.
That's fantastic. It's nice to see that, like, Aqueduct Press, a relatively small press, is actually going to get some attention. That's great.
Absolutely. I've loved the work that they do for years now, and I really want it to be better known, like, especially in the atmosphere of, like, everyone talking about wanting more diversity in their reading and stuff like that. I just want to be like, look at, like, this amazing long list of fantastic books by really fantastic people doing interesting things.
So I've invited the two of you on tonight to talk about a topic which is near and dear to all of our hearts, ethics in literary journalism. Now, obviously, we are riffing on the absurdity of ethics in video game journalism, which has been thrown around over the last couple of months. I mean, it's, like, become a meme. It's utterly ridiculous. But it really got me thinking about an actual serious discussion about ethics in literary journalism or blogging or whatever you want to call it. It's something that we've all been involved in, and conversations that we're having with ourselves all the time, but I don't think it's a conversation we have out loud very often. Mm-hmm. So, Amal, when I say ethics in book journalism, like, what's your first reaction to just that statement?
Oh, my first reaction is to be hugely annoyed at Gamergate, like, in among their millions of other egregious faults. The fact that this has been a serious conversation I've been wanting to have for easily the past year is now sort of stolen by this odious group of people is really frustrating. But my first reaction is basically to think about the power relations involved between authors, reviewers, and readers, and the ways in which those three categories are not actually distinct and are becoming more and more fluid and more level thanks to the internet and the way the internet is moving. So I think about those dynamics a lot and the way that those dynamics end up inflecting the conversations that we have around books and writing. And also I think about the fact that because I'm an author and I'm a reviewer and I'm a reader, I am all of those things. It starts to make me think about, can we look at a review as a thing that is a work that should be commented on or shouldn't be commented on, the way that, you know, books are commented on or not commented on, etc. There's still pieces of writing, there's still performances, there's still, you know, texts. So mostly I think about the power dynamics and how they're not things that you can take for granted in a way that in the past I think you probably could.
I think a lot about the power dynamics too. We see that a lot in like the romance community, where people try to draw a very firm line between reader space versus author space, and the two shouldn't touch. But in like science fiction, you know, we're all up in each other's business. There is no, like, I go to Tor.com and it's reader space, but it's also author space.
Mm-hmm.
It's everything all wadded up together. It's not. So it's an interesting tension that you see in these, and it plays out, I think, differently in the communities. And I think there's expectations that are different. And it's just interesting because in romance, it's very like that reviews are for readers. And I believe that pretty strongly. So an author shouldn't come in and comment on a review of their book. But if that author read another book and wanted to talk about it, what is the appropriate place for them to do that? You know, where do we draw the line? You know, the power differentials in you and who has a, and I think audience size comes into this too.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a big thing.
Audience size is absolutely a big thing. And I think that audience size is something that can no longer be the single determining factor of a power dynamic situation in the way that I think it did used to be. Because now the speed and ease with which things can go viral is no longer tied to a specific follower count or general idea of audience or what have you. But there's a phrase that I was reading on, I think, a Nigerian blogger's blog, gosh, about half a year ago at this point, when the Boko Haram stuff first started up being like a thing that bring back our girls became a hashtag and all that stuff. This blogger started talking about the politics of attention. And I feel terrible. I'm going to look this up and maybe you can put it in the show notes. Because I want to give credit where it's due. Because it was an enormously powerful phrase, I thought. And one that was so useful to think about the way that the internet's changing and the way that affects the conversations we have on it and where we have them. It used to be that you had authors having an audience and that meant that the politics of attention they commanded was commensurate with that audience. So yeah, if you were an author and you complained about a reviewer, one review somewhere, then you had the power to leverage that audience and that audience's attention against that one reviewer. And that was a really kind of top-down relationship. But increasingly, I think that dynamic is being leveled out and diluted, and the speed at which collective action can take place with something like Twitter means that those politics of attention can actually be activated by anyone at a given moment and make anyone subject to the same scrutiny and negative attention that, you know, that hypothetical reviewer could have been at the hands of that author and that one author's audience. Does that make sense?
It does, but I'm not sure I agree.
Okay.
And the reason I'm saying I'm not sure I agree is because I'm thinking of like, okay, I am thinking of one specific author whose name might be Anne Rice.
Oh, yeah, for sure. That's a really good example, actually.
You know, where, yeah, you know, she has periodically done stupid shit on the internet.
Yeah.
The Amazon reviewer, she's like, you're interrogating the text from the wrong perspective.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Which is like, you know, a phrase for the ages. But then she has also done things like, you know, somebody bought a used copy of one of her books and used it in an art project. And she posts, and Anne Rice found out about it and posted about it on her Facebook page. Mm-hmm. And sent all her fans over to tell this person what a horrible person they were for cutting up a used book.
That is absolutely abhorrent behavior, and I am completely in agreement about that. Like,
I mean, it's just
exactly the thing I was talking about. Like, I don't think, I should be clear, I don't think that the power that an author has via their audience is diminished. I just think that on the other side of the equation, a lot more people have that the power to kind of direct the attention of the internet onto one person purely by being part of like an enormous collective wave. My friend Tessa Kum, who is, you know, tremendously dear to me and who I adore, started the I'll Ride With You hashtag. And she started it. Are you guys familiar with the, should I even ask that question? Is everyone familiar with the I'll Ride With You hashtag?
She started it after the shootings in Australia, correct?
Yeah, after the hostage taking situation there. The Sydney siege was the hashtag. So she started it because there were, because she was becoming aware of, via the internet, of Muslims who were feeling afraid of going out in public, knowing that this was going on, you know, fearing hate crimes and stuff like that. And she wanted to start something saying, you know, if you want, this is my bus journey from home to work. If you're on it and you can read this, then I will sit with you on the bus and I will, you know, at least, you know, keep you company and be a sort of buffer between you and assholes, basically. And she literally started it as a really, really local sort of thing. She was like, maybe a bunch of us could sort of start a hashtag just for each other and we'll be able to share our details. It was enormously practical and pragmatic and just like, this is how we're going to make this tiny at the level of our community change. And it took off within an hour. And I think I actually almost saw it taking off in real time, where suddenly, you know, she went from a couple of hundred followers on Twitter to several thousand. And that hashtag went through the sort of hashtag dialectic, as I think of it, where it went from that one thing to being blown up into this thing where, you know, it was all about solidarity, global solidarity with Muslims all over the world. And then as a consequence of that, mm-hmm. drew all the haters to it who are like, rah, Muslims suck and rah, et cetera. And because she was getting media attention as a consequence of this, a lot of that hatred was directed against her as well. And yeah. She didn't try to do any of this. She literally was trying to do something which might be seen by 10 to 15 people. And she had no control over it purely because of this leverage. So that is a total digression, but only to say that that's the kind of thing that I'm talking about, where one person can super innocuously make any kind of comment, positive or negative, be it an author, be it a reader, be it a reviewer, and the scope for it to travel and attract attention is just so vast now in a way that it wasn't even, I'd say, 2 years ago.
But I think that almost, you have to be in the right place at the right time. It's a serendipitous thing, almost a serendipitous thing that happens. Mm-hmm. So I'm pretty sure your friend Tessa didn't sit there and think, okay, what is the perfect hashtag I could create?
Exactly.
That will go fine. You know, she just did it.
Yeah.
Whereas somebody like an author, like an Anne Rice, you know, she's got this built-in audience already.
We have lots of people within the literary journalistic community who have a range of audience sizes. And I think the vast majority of us have exceedingly small audiences. You know, it might be 100, it might be 200, it might be 2000.
Sure.
And then we have a few who have what I would consider, at least relatively speaking, massive audiences.
Yes.
Chuck Wendig, yeah. John Scalzi, Shannon McGuire is another great example. And then we have some bloggers that have really large audiences, like The Book Smugglers, mm-hmm. Dear Author. But somebody like Natalie or myself or whoever.
I have tiny traffic.
Tiny traffic. But we can say something, and if the right person with one of these larger audiences picks up on it, and they will and do, even a tiny little blog can have a huge impact and mm-hmm. really move the needle. And I don't think any of us can debate that.
Yeah, that I will say I have seen that happening with Dave Truesdale, because I'm apparently the person who yells at him.
Really?
When he says something stupid on the internet, I am the person who gets, I'm the person who has to write the thing about Dave Truesdale saying something dumb.
I am so sorry.
Well, you know, he did that petition thing last year, which was just completely ridiculous.
Oh, it still burns.
I know. And then he did the whole women destroy science fiction, and I'm like going, and he wrote that editorial, and I'm just like, oh my God, I have to write this thing.
You know, he wasn't even the worst defender on the editorial thing. Like, oh, I've, the dude who wrote about like how basically Christy Yant was, I don't know, standing on a sidewalk and shouting at passersby or something like that. That dude, man, he earned my ire. He was just, Although, actually, okay, this is something that I'm, that if I could sort of shift gears slightly, this is something I'm really interested in. Talking of Tangent, Tangent produces reviews. There are reviewers who review stuff at Tangent.
Yes, and I had the most awkward conversation with a Tangent reviewer at ReaderCon last year.
Yeah, I don't want to, like, so I don't want to, again, being aware of a certain power dynamic, I don't want to be naming and shaming right now, which is interesting to me even as I think about it. You know, I think that fits into the sort of ethics question and stuff. But I often strenuously, deeply disagree with reviews on Tangent. And I mean, so far, they've not been about my work. It's been about other people's work. And this has led me to, you know, riposte, as it were, like to just kind of say, no, all right, this review that you wrote, person, you are so bigoted and homophobic. I cannot even begin to engage with the nonsense that you have written about, you know, this amazingly excellent story, which I love very much. And so I am going to get on my blog and I am going to tell the internet how wrong you are, because you are so wrong. So, I mean, that's an instance of me, both as a reader and as a reviewer, responding to another reviewer. So I don't know, there's that, but one that was slightly more problematic for me, but that I totally did anyway, because I was just so pissed off, was when, there was that, like, weird amalgamated Tangent review of Women Destroy Science Fiction, and there was that one reviewer who was like, rawr, Christy Yant, rawr. I was furious, and I responded to that as well with a sort of takedown. I was like, no, this is where you're wrong, this is how you're wrong, and you are so wrong. But I'm a contributor to that anthology. I have a story in Women Destroy Science Fiction. So even though I'm not actually contradicting, I'm not responding to a review of my story, I am responding to a review of the anthology that my story is in, and pretty angrily for that matter. And I guess, you know, I think this is a crystalline kind of moment of looking at ethics, is like, where do the ethics in that situation fall? Are they, you know, to fall along the line of, just don't respond to reviews, just let them stand for what they are, or is something else happening?
Well, you know, I think in that particular case, that series, that amalgamation, aggregate review was so fractally wrong that I think it almost would have been impossible for anybody to sit on their hands and be quiet.
Yeah.
You know, it's like when you read a review of a book, and it's very clear that the person reviewing the book didn't actually read the book.
Well, like, literally all these reviews of, they were like just reviews of Christiane's editorial. Like,
well, yeah, they were reviewing the personal essays.
They were actually not even that. They were reviewing the worthiness of the project as a whole, which was just also extremely frustrating to read because of the fact, I mean, it's happened. It's not like the fact that it's going to happen is up for debate, but they're still judging, like trying to decide whether or not it should have happened, which was tremendously weird to me. But an example of what I would really like to kind of jump into and talk about. When this was, I think this was also last year, when Long Hidden came out, the Long Hidden anthology, and there was a review of it in Strange Horizons that took exception to a story that had dialect in it, and basically sort of dismissed the dialect as a kind of literary trick, when actually, like, I mean, the dialect was really integral to the voice and the story and the character and so on. And Daniel Jose Older, who is one of the editors of the anthology, started talking on Twitter about how that review was just wrong. Like, could you maybe not review things this way when it's so important to the project of the anthology that there's a diversity of voices, a diversity of styles, and that dialect is actually the way, you know, the author speaks, is actually a completely legitimate representation of speech. It's not a literary trick. It's something that should be considered as natural as, you know, standard hegemonic Western English. I don't even know. I mean, that's an instance of like one of the editors of the anthology taking a reviewer to task for their review of a specific story in the anthology. But it's also one that's taking a really ethical stance, and kind of contradicting the review based on an ethical stance. So I don't know. What do you think of that?
Well, the thing that got me about that specific incident was that the rest of the review of that anthology was excellent.
Okay.
They had nothing but nice things to say about it. And I felt like, yeah, that was a badly written, badly edited, should not have come out of their fingers sentence.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like they maybe shouldn't have been cast as this horrible racist person for saying it. Which is not what I'm saying Daniel Jose Older did precisely, but it, from my perspective, which is a white lady perspective, I was just like, this seems like a little bit much, especially since Strange Horizons immediately apologized.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they immediately saw the problem, and I assume they fixed it.
And this is another question that I have about these situations. I mean, do you think that that's what the publication ought to have done? Like to apologize for it and to retract it, or to let it stand? Or like, how do you feel about the way that they handled that situation?
I think Strange Horizons handled it in a really good way. And, you know, I think they, and I'm assuming they went back and they edited that sentence. I assume they consulted with the person who wrote the review, who apparently had no idea any of this was happening because they weren't on Twitter.
I actually didn't know that the reviewer wasn't on Twitter. And that's, it's so bizarre that should actually change the way that I think about it. Because having recently, like, gotten only the tiniest taste of what it's like when people start flooding your mentions with, let's just say negativity, because I mean, in my case, I think that the people flooding my mentions were horrible jerks, whereas I don't think that's always the case with people who are just being critical. But I know that, but I've now had that taste of like having your mentions just flooded with people who you don't know expressing an opinion on something that you have said, that you thought was totally innocuous.
So we recognize that this review was written and it was an opinion was expressed. And there were some poor word choices in the way the opinion was expressed. But if the opinion that was expressed was, this is a perfectly viable dialogue. I found it difficult to read, and it threw me out of the story, and I didn't like the story as a result. To me, that's a perfectly legitimate thing to put into a review. Now, The words that she chose in the review perhaps weren't the right words to be chosen. There's that one thing where she wrote this review, and she put it out there. And then we have this ethical question of then is it okay for the author to come in and criticize a review, or the editor in this case, to criticize a review of the work because they didn't agree with it. Now, I think we're a little bit of a unique perspective in here because there were questions that were sort of like, you're being culturally insensitive here as opposed to just being critical of the work, which I think that's a fair criticism for Daniel to make.
Oh, absolutely. I think that is absolutely a fair criticism. I don't even want to debate that.
But I do think there's a real ethical question here that we can talk about sort of rather than drilling into the specific case, is to have a question about the larger scope, which is a review by this blogger or reviewer, professional or amateur, is it okay for it merely to be a response of my feelings about the work? Or do I have a responsibility to be aware that like my words have power? And that people are going to read them, and that they can offend or hurt or damage things.
I think to a certain extent, it depends on your audience. I mean, who you're writing for. If I'm like writing an email to a friend of mine, obviously I'm going to write the review a very different way than if I'm writing it for, say, RT, or if I'm writing it for my blog, or if I'm writing it for Tor.com. I mean, there's going to be different modalities in the language I use and the word choices I use, because I know that in each one of those cases, the audience is getting perhaps slightly larger.
Mm-hmm.
And there's going to be different constraints upon my speech. So like I might say to a friend of mine, you know, this book had this character and, you know, and I really hated this character because X, Y, Z. If I'm writing a review on my blog, I might be like, well, this character didn't really work for me because of A, B, C. I'm just trying to frame this up in my mind. But I'm going to use different words depending on my audience. So like I'm thinking if I'm like writing a review for, say, a Strange Horizons or a Lightspeed or a Tor.com, I'm going to keep the larger audience, I think, in mind and be a lot more careful with the words I use than I am when I am Justin and be all like, oh my God, you won't believe this piece of crap I just read.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree. I'm also finding a weird thing where, I mean, this shouldn't be just a kind of binary thing that the way that I'm going to express it, but it makes a huge difference to me if I'm being paid for the review or not. I don't do it as much now as I used to, but the way I write a Goodreads review is very different to the way I write an NPR review. And I do allow myself a lot. I mean, I still try to be, if I see, in terms of the audience question, I do find myself also constrained by whether or not I think the author is ever going to see the review. And this is interesting to me because it gets expressed in really weirdly nuanced ways, that I've noticed and I kind of laugh at myself about. If I write a review on NPR and so first of all, I should say, reviews on NPR, I'm strongly discouraged from, if not outright, just not allowed to, review the books of people who are my friends. On NPR, which is extremely difficult in the science fiction and fantasy communities, because usually when I like a person's writing, I become friends with them. It's just a thing that I've been tremendously fortunate in. I then become friends with them, and then I can't review their books.
We're all up in each other's business all the time.
Exactly. So I've ended up, like, the way that I sort of deal with that, in the sort of, you know, full disclosure side of ethics and literary journalism, is I end up sort of itemizing to in really sort of ridiculous detail the relationship that I've had with that person to my editor at NPR. So I'll be like, right, okay, Petra, so this person, right, I've been at the same dinner as them at a con, but there were like 14 people there, so I don't think that we're really friends per se, but I am acquainted with them. Or sometimes I'll be like, okay, this is the degree to which I talk to this person on Twitter, but I've never met them, you know, weird things like that. And I end up just letting my editor decide whether or not that is an appropriate amount of distance. But what ends up happening when I write the review is, most often I find, because I get a lot of say in the reviews that I write for NPR, in terms of the books that I choose, I mean, most often my reviews end up being pretty positive. But there's always this weird moment when I go to actually tweet that the review's gone live. I have this moment of, do I tag the author or not? Do I want to bring this review to the author's attention or not? And I'm utterly inconsistent about this. And I keep trying to sort of figure out where that line is drawn. Like, if it was an unabashedly glowing review, then sometimes I feel comfortable tagging the author. But sometimes I don't, weirdly. I don't really know why. But I, like, feel weirdly shy. Like, I don't want them to feel like I've written them a fan letter, or that they're obligated in any way to respond. But I kind of want them to know. But anyways, it's this weird negotiation. And then if the review that I've written is a little bit critical, like, even the smallest bit critical, I never want to tag them. I just figure, like, you know, I don't know what's going to upset them or not. I was as honest as I could be about it. I don't know how I would feel if someone tagged me in a review of my work and it was, like, critical of some aspect that I actually felt really strongly about. So I just don't do it. But it is this weird thing that I'm just bizarrely inconsistent about.
Yeah, I know when I actually bother reviewing a book, I often don't bother tagging the author, in part because I just feel like, you know, number one, chances are I'm going to use their name in the tweet anyways, and I think most people ego search themselves every so often.
Right.
So it'll pop up. It'll pop up in their Google alerts. They will find the review eventually.
Right.
So I mean, I don't really care about that, but the interesting thing is when I was reviewing for RT, ethically, it was a lot easier for me because I wasn't all that friendly with that many authors at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And since I have left, I've become a lot more friendly with a lot more authors, to the point where it's like, I don't know if I can actually review some of your books now because I think we're maybe, like, too friendly, or if I read your book and I don't like it,
yeah,
you know, are you going to be mad at me? And I think part of this might be, I think this might actually be part of the reason behind my gigantic reading block, where I haven't been reading as much as I used to the point where I don't even think I read 20 books last year, which is just unthinkable to me. But it's like, I have all these books I want to read, but I'm like going, But as long as the book remains unread, there's a possibility that I'm going to love it.
I admit, like, I closed my blog largely for this reason, because I got to the point where I was reading for too many people and providing feedback into too many books of people who I considered friends, but also, like, if I'm in the acknowledgments, like, I can't review that book. Like, it's that, that's really getting into sort of a problematic territory.
Right.
Talking a lot about, like, these individual code of conducts that we've all conjured up within our own playbooks, right? Like, okay, well, I'll do this, but I won't do this. 3 degrees of separation is fine, but, like, anything closer than that, now we have a problem. And a lot of what you've brought up, Amal, is actually not specific to literary blogging so much as it's related to just sort of blogging at large.
Yeah.
And we've sort of been skirting around this idea of, like, blogging and reviewing. Is there a distinction between blogging and reviewing, Natalie, where, like, you can – that if I'm blogging, which you do a lot, right, where you write about social issues or, like, things that books are doing in general and not really reviewing, but you do review sometimes. Do you see a difference between blogging and reviewing?
Oh, gosh. I mean, because when I was doing it for RT, the reviews were so friggin' short. I mean, 200 words, which is a really short review. Especially when it's a 600-page book, and you have to have a paragraph of plot summary. I try not to make it personal in either case. I try not to say, okay, so-and-so, you're a dick. I'll say, you're being a dick. You've said a dickish thing.
I didn't call you one. You're just acting like
one. Which is
you're not actually physically a penis. You're just behaving in a way.
That makes me kind of squint and think, it looks a little like a penis.
Yeah.
I mean, and I know for certain, I know, like, you know, it's when you're saying somebody's being wrong and they're wrongity wrong, wrong, wrong. The line between you're acting like a penis and you are a penis is very thin.
But, like, when you go from that blog where you're saying, like, I'm making a commentary on an issue, right, where I think we can all agree you can get away with, like, saying, like, you're acting like a penis. But when you're writing a review, when you are, like, trying to formally say something about a work in particular, does that increase your sort of so-called ethical liability?
Well, I mean, when I write a review, I pretend like the author's dead.
Hmm.
You know? I mean, it's me and the text. I mean, what the author intended doesn't even come into play for it. You know, I just, you know, ethically, you know, in terms of what I can ethically say about a book, I mean, I've seen it, you know, this book, it's kind of sexist in some places. Robert Heinlein, you pig-looking sort of man.
In which case, the author is actually dead.
Amal, you've reviewed for a lot of different places. But you, as far as I can tell, you've never actually sort of had, like, your own review blog. Like, it hasn't been, like, not like a book blog, sort of like what I had or what, you know, the book smugglers do. Like, that's never really been your bag. And my guess is you've never been in the position where you were receiving, you know, 120 or 200 or 300 books a year from publishers like I was until recently. And I want to talk a little bit about the ethical relationship between the reviewer, the blogger, and the publisher.
Mm-hmm.
And publishers send books to people for review.
Mm-hmm.
In the blogging community, at least in sort of the independent blogging community, there's sort of this line at which, like, I am a reviewer who receives review copies and I am not a reviewer who receives review copies, either because my audience isn't large enough or because I'm just that full of integrity that I've decided not to accept review copies.
Well, I know in romance, there's been a number of romance bloggers who've decided they are no longer going to accept review copies because they don't feel like being under any sort of obligation to actually review the book.
Well, so that's the question, right? Like, does receiving a review copy, have you ever felt like receiving a review copy, Amal, has obligated you to review a book?
I used to back in the, when it was like 2004, I used to review for the SF site and I felt obligated to, that was the only time I felt an obligation attached to the books I was receiving because they were assigned to me. It wasn't an obligation to the publisher, it was an obligation to the editors of the site, that I was, you know, going to read the thing that I'd been assigned and review it because, you know, I chose it, I picked it, or it was assigned to me and someone else could have taken it, etc. So that was like, it was more the obligation of, not an employee because I wasn't paid, but it was just that was the obligation that I felt. I've never felt an obligation to review a book because a publisher gave me an ARC. I mean, the whole purpose of ARCs is for promotion. Publishers know that it's a crapshoot when they send them out whether or not there is going to be a review. In fact, it's happened a few times now that, I've deliberately asked for a copy of something to review for NPR and for NPR. And my editor gets in touch with the publicist to get the ARC sent. And after I've, you know, read the book and done the review, but it hasn't gone up yet, there's a sort of twilight period where the publicist gets in touch with me to ask me whether or not I decided to review the book. And that's always been odd to me, because I was like, I know I literally asked for this book because I wanted to read it and review it. And I did, in fact, review it. I've never yet had to answer no to that question. I can't imagine being a book blogger and being sent books by a publisher and feeling an obligation to review them, because no, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, the publisher just makes the decision when they send a copy out into the ether that they're taking a gamble on whether or not the person is A, going to like the book in the first place, or B, is going to feel like they have enough to say about it to warrant a review. So I don't feel like the ARC places an obligation. And I've often been really interested actually by that line of like, I must disclose that I received this as an ARC, because I felt like what that implies is that getting the book for free might somehow better dispose someone to a favorable review. And I'm just like, really?
No. The reason for that, Amal, is in the U.S., you're supposed to, the Federal Trade Commission, if you have a blog, you are supposed to disclose that you may have received items for free for review.
Really?
Yes. Huh. So that is one reason why people disclose. That is why I disclose if I get an ARC. So
I blogged for years and thought that it was the most absurd requirement ever, and I've never heard of anybody getting in any trouble for it. And because I agree with you, Amal, I always felt like it created an implication that I had been compensated for my review by a free book.
Right. Yeah. But it's not. It's giving you the means to create the review in the first place.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, and I think to a certain extent, you see this more in some of the blogs, like I read some like home organizing blogs, you know, some of those where the people are making a living blogging.
Right.
So they get a lot of free shit.
Mm-hmm.
Those are really the situations that this rule is designed around, not the people who are maybe getting 20 free books a month from publishers.
Mm-hmm.
And so many of the galleys these days, they're electronic too. I mean, and I know NetGalley and Edelweiss, they cost money, but still I think the overhead is still less now that they're electronic than that they were paper. Because it used to be, especially for like really big titles, some of the publishers would treat them like they were gold and hoard them. I mean, I got ARCs for titles for some like New York Times best-selling authors, and they were numbered. And the reason they're numbered is so if it goes up on eBay, they know who the asshole is who sold it. I mean, people do, though. I mean, I give mine I would take these giant boxes to Goodwill. You know, because after a certain point, you can't take them to the library. Oh, and you don't want to put them in the trash, because that's just wasteful.
I gave away 40 ARCs as part of the Strange Horizon fundraiser this year. We called it Landon's Loot, and it was like if somebody got it, I just put a bunch of ARCs that I never read in a box and I sent them to somebody. Libraries won't take them a lot of times. And used bookstores won't take them.
Yeah, this is actually the question for me, because I often get sent not ARCs, but the actual book.
Me too.
And that is actually a problem I have, because I look at it and I go, well, this is a perfectly good book, which I could actually give to a library. I could actually, you know, just kind of give it away and so on. But at the same time, if I'm making a living freelancing and I don't have room for more books, but here are these books that I've already read and don't want to read again and want to sell to have some money, then is that bad? I haven't done it yet, because I've actually been pondering this question.
I took a bunch to half price books and I get like, you know, $30 every month or something, or 2 months, you know, where I take a stack of books down. I mean, what else am I going to do with them?
At that point, they're not like, it's still, when you've been given the book, I just feel like it's not a trust between you and the publisher anymore, then that, like, it is just the book. You have it. It's not like, an arc, so there isn't that kind of advanced aspect to it that is part of its, I don't know. It's weird. It's something I think about.
What it's a relic.
I feel like it's a sunk cost on the part of the publisher, because is this part of their promotional budget?
Exactly. I mean, if I won a book in sweepstakes or whatever, I wouldn't feel like that I shouldn't sell it on afterwards. It is actually something that belongs to me, that has become my property through this, you know, totally free interaction, you know? So I don't know.
It's not like they're sacred objects, you know, and I think some people get a little weird about it.
Well, and so much of it's a relic of like publishing gone by, right? Like the do not quote from this book, only quote from the finished copy. Like,
yes.
That's not happening.
I mean, like, really? You really?
I'm going to quote from the art.
I have to get this in 3 months before it's published.
Right. But they send you that copy, that finished copy, because of that relic. Mm-hmm. That it's dead. Like, nobody, it's so weird when I get the ARC, I get the finished copy, I get the paperback 8 months later.
I don't get that many anymore, in part because I moved and didn't tell any of them my address. because I wasn't really reviewing anymore, and I was thinking, you know, maybe I should. Actually, I think Orbit has my current address. But that's just so they can send me Ann Leckie's books.
There you go. So it sounds like we agree that there is no ethical relationship to publishers pretty much at all.
I think the only ethical obligation you have is if they send you the review copy, and if you tell them you're going to review it, maybe you should actually review it, and maybe you should actually read the book.
Yeah, reading the book before you review it is, I think, pretty important. I mean, it's happened actually for me.
It is possible to skim and write a perfectly serviceable review, but I don't recommend it.
No, I wouldn't do that. I mean, it's happened. I used to review for Publishers Weekly, and it has happened a couple of times in that case where I've just said, no, I can't review this book. It is too terrible. Like, it's so terrible, this book, that I, like, the amount that I'm being paid to review it is not enough to justify the cost of my time reading it. So in that case, I'm just like, what I would not do in that situation is, you know, write a lambasting review about how terrible the book was that I couldn't even devote the time to finishing it, because that would just not be within the remit of my job as a reviewer of Publishers Weekly. It's only happened once so far that there was a book for NPR that I was having such a powerfully negative reaction to that I actually had to write to my editor and say, I'm sorry, I cannot review this book. It is so appalling. And the one time that I said that, I recognized that probably it was just a massive disconnect between me and this particular author's style that, you know, that loads of other people might absolutely have no problem with it whatsoever, but I could not bring myself to read it. And I knew that if I did read it, because, you know, NPR's rates are such that I could actually put myself through the trouble of reading it. But I just thought that, you know what, I don't want to be giving this book the review that I would have to end up giving it, because I just don't want to. That's another ethical question for me, actually, because in this case, the reviewer was a woman, someone completely unknown to me. But I just realized that I didn't want to spend the effort lambasting a woman's work when I could instead use my reading time to read something that I liked a lot better and be promoting a woman's work. So that was just like a personal decision in that case. I don't actually know if they even assigned it to someone else, but yeah.
Well, I know in one case I had to hurry up, read a book really super fast with RT. Basically, there was an author who I used to review, and I got to the point where I could not read the books anymore. But I found that one of the other reviewers liked them. Mm-hmm. So she was doing it, and then she got ill, but like right before deadline.
Oh.
And this book was a big release, and it had to be reviewed. And the only person who could do it was me.
Oh.
I've got to say, I have never read a book so fast and so cursorially in my life just to get it done. Because I knew going in I wasn't going to like it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I no longer enjoyed this person's work. Flat out just didn't like it. But deadline.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I knew none of the other reviewers that I sent books out to would be willing to touch it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it wasn't their thing. So like, okay, I'm reading it. I'm going to say, okay, is this the sort of thing that people who enjoy these books will like? Yes or no? That was sort of the rubric in my head.
that's another aspect of the ethical question to me, I guess, is like when you're, and I think this is different when you're reviewing something for yourself and when you're reviewing something for a venue. When you're reviewing something for yourself on your own blog, the context of your enjoyment is you. I mean, that is, you are writing purely from your context. You're writing, like you have no obligation or even expectation to explain or elucidate the context of you for anyone else. You're writing it for yourself. You're writing it for your friends who know you. So, you know, that's one thing. But I find when I'm reviewing for a venue, my obligation is to lay out that context, the context in which I've received and read and appreciated or not the book. And I kind of lay that. So, like, I say something, for instance, like, I consider myself a pretty poor reader of horror. I don't seek it out. I don't have a whole lot of familiarity with the breadth and depth of that particular subgenre. I just, I'm not drawn to it. But every now and then I have to review something with really strong horror elements or that is a horror book. And I struggle sometimes with going, all right, is my disconnect with this story happening because I don't like horror or because the story is actually not working? So I try to kind of just put that out there and say, I'm not usually a reader of horror. This is my feeling on it. But it also happens in cases where, when I reviewed Nicola Griffith's Hild, I felt it was important to talk about the fact that there'd been this conversation recently, like in the year leading up to its release, about women in historical fiction. And that put the book for me in a really specific context that enriched my reading of it, and that made me all the more grateful for that book and how stupendous it is, because of all these conversations that have been happening about, you know, where are the women in historical fiction? Why are they always being relegated to these specific roles? Mm-hmm. So, but that's not an obligation that I feel I would have had if I were just reviewing it for myself. If I were, you know, just purely talking about my relationship to the book. So yeah.
Well, yeah, the interesting thing there is, you know, I do a lot of that. When I do review books now, I try to contextualize that sort of thing. It helps me clarify my thinking about the book.
Right.
But when you're writing for like a venue like RT where you only have 200 words, there's no room for contextualizing. There's no room for me to put myself into the review at all.
Yeah, I completely agree. Like, that's the way Publishers Weekly was as well. It's a very formulaic review. It's like, you know, a sort of catchy lead-in, brief plot synopsis, then summary kind of assessing the success of the project on the whole. And that's it. Your like 200 words, exactly.
Yeah, and you can say things like, you know, fans of this series will enjoy the latest installment of...
Yes,
exactly. You know, you get these shorthand phrases you use to signal to readers.
Can I ask, are the RT reviews, were they anonymous?
No.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah, they were not anonymous. They are tied to each person who wrote them. So,
Okay.
Yeah,
I know the Publishers Weekly ones obviously were anonymous. It's just, I was trying to think about, you know, whether or not being anonymous changed the way I reviewed a thing. But I think I was always, I don't know, weird. Like, I never really, even when a book was really terrible, I never really had it in for the book. I don't know. Maybe it's just that there wasn't room enough to be really vituperative or something.
I'm trying to think. There were a couple times I read books and I kind of sort of had it in for them. Mm-hmm. I'm not even going to lie there, because I remember I read this. It was probably the worst book I have ever had the misfortune of reading. It was a cozy mystery where the main character was a professional mediator and also a decorative gourd artist.
Wait, so I mean they did art on gourds? Or
yes,
did they just drew
yes,
gourds?
This is a thing. She painted pumpkins and shit.
Okay.
And then the whole impetus for the murder that happens in the book, because of course it was a murder mystery, was this horrible act of hazing / sexual violation that made absolutely no sense. And she was the most passive aggressive, nosy, mealy mouth. Oh, it was terrible. It was the worst book.
This sounds like a bizarre K.J. Parker novel. You know, like, K.J. Parker, like, goes into weird detail about strange professions? Like, Parker hasn't done gourd artists yet, so I think maybe we should look into that.
Decorative gourd artists. Yeah, they paint, like, folksy little scenes and stuff on them, and it's just, like...
Okay, Natalie, I have to know, did you know this before reading the book, or did you, as a consequence of reading this book, actually research decorative gourd artists to understand what their deal was?
I am from the Midwest.
Say no more.
And I'm foreign, so I don't actually understand what that means in this context. Are there a lot of decorative gourd artists in the Midwest?
There are not a lot of decorative gourd artists in the Midwest, but we have a lot of craft shows.
Okay.
Amal, earlier you kind of brought up this notion of performative blogging,
mm-hmm.
and it's actually connected to all this. So we talked about receiving review copies and how it maybe doesn't offer an obligation, but there's no question that a lot of bloggers want to receive review copies, that it's, you know, it's sort of like, oh, well, it'd be great if I got a bunch of free books sent to my house every week.
Right.
And so it's sort of like a thing that people try to attain.
And then you start getting the free books, and then you're like, what did I just do?
Yeah, right. Like, my wife was ready to, like, throw me out of the house because, you know, we're, like, drowning in books. And so, but a lot of this is fed by this. If I get enough traffic, I can be relevant. Or, like, I can – and to get that level of relevancy, you almost have to participate in what you might call, like, performative blogging, which is where mm-hmm. you are blogging in an effort to attract attention. I mean, it's just – the nature of writing, right? I mean, obviously, if you write something, you want people to read it,
right.
But it's an escalation of this. You know, like, I write something, people respond to it, I get this many hits. Well, geez, if I had only gone a little further, I would have gotten more. And it leads to this escalation, mm-hmm. and us having these conversations in public, and an expectation of response and answering of responses. How does this feed into this concept of, like, having authenticity and integrity when you blog? Because authenticity and integrity are not often the best ways to get attention.
I try very hard in my engagements on the internet to, and whether they're around blogs or whether they're reviews, like wherever they're happening, I feel like there's a lot that is totally permissible to do that I wouldn't do just because I would hate to have someone behave that way towards me. So I feel like the nature of the performance that I'm willing to do with reviewing is very limited. Like, I think that I could, because I'm a writer, because I, like all writers, have a tendency towards hyperbole, because it's really fun to talk about things in a really passionate way, in a sometimes really angry way. I think that I could totally, you know, have a go at making a performance that is based around being really, I don't know, tearing a book down, being furious about it, like making a point of reviewing things that I hate. And I think that, you know, some people do that to tremendous effect and, you know, are very successful in terms of garnering attention with it. I just don't ultimately see the point, I think, for myself. I look at that and I go, it seems to require so much energy that I just don't have, or energy that kind of fuels an engine that is sort of constantly destroying itself, is the way I end up thinking about it. So I feel that, like, whether or not, you know, a sort of gracious, I don't know, behavior on in reviews and so on, whether or not it attracts attention is sort of besides the point for me, because I just, there's a further level of behavior that I just want to hold myself to in a really boring sort of golden rule-y sort of way, of just not wanting people to be horrible to me, so trying to not be horrible to people. I don't know, it's not the most exciting answer to that question, I guess. And I'm sure there are more exciting ones that are really, you know, kind of courageous and I will just blog as angrily as I feel about a book, etc. I have a lot of respect for people who do that, but it's not something I ever feel like I can sustain. And there's always at the back of my head this feeling of, you know, what is the net good that is coming out of this thing that I am doing? And I kind of always want to be contributing to that if possible. Like, if I can instead build someone up rather than tear someone down, I'd rather err on the side of building someone up. Another person, not the same person, I have to say, if I feel like someone is, you know, the only response I can have to them is to go, ugh, no. I'd rather just read something else and go, yes, this is great.
Well, I mean, I think the idea, the performative nature of blogging is something that's sort of baked into blogging. I've been blogging in one way or another since about 1999. I spent a long chunk on LiveJournal locked down, but I used to have a public blog right at the start of the whole thing. And you got a lot of sort of performative stuff going on. People were writing really personal stuff, you know? Mm-hmm. And you see this a lot, and this is like the mommy bloggers. They write these things that are really personal about their children and about their family lives. And I'm like, do you really want to be talking about little Johnny's temper tantrums? Mm. You know, when little Johnny is 15, you know, I think he's going to be a little upset that you talked about his temper tantrums over his Thomas the Train Engines or whatever. This performative nature is sort of like baked in, and you get these people, you know, like, you know, Metafilter is a big giant group blog, and, you know, Boing Boing's a blog, and so you get all these sites that, you know, kind of grew into these big giant things that started out as essentially blogs, and you get people who have careers in doing internet-y things because they happen to be at the right place in the right time performing on the internet to mm-hmm. a certain degree.
Do you see that performative nature continuing to increase the way it has, this continued escalation, or do you think that the merging of traditional print journalism into the online spaces is going to bring with it more, I don't want to say decorum, that's the wrong word, because like, let's...
I have two words for you, GIF reviews. Those are so performative.
They're fantastic.
They are. A really well done GIF review is a great thing to look at if you can watch GIFs, because a lot of people can't. Like, I've got a couple of friends, and they can't. It gives them migraines. Mm-hmm. Which I'm like, wait, this is so sad. I feel really sad for you that you can't experience this, the glory that is a GIF review. But a badly done GIF review is like, you're just like, you're trying too hard. There's mm-hmm. this balance, this effortlessness, you know?
But I think it's interesting that we've gone from 10 years ago to having tons of what I'll call mom and pop blogs.
Personal blogs.
Yeah, personal blogs. I mean, just somebody hanging a shingle, you know, doing their own thing. Mm-hmm. And now we've got, like you mentioned, Boing Boing, you know, let's look at Daily Dot, Toast, Tor.com, IO9, and they're snapping up most of the talented writers. At least anybody who wants to write for them that's talented is ending up there rather than at their own blog, or they're shifting their work to those areas, partially because they pay, but also because they're a larger platform. And as Amal sort of hinted at, when she writes for places like NPR or Publishers Weekly or whatever, there's an editor now, right? There's somebody sort of saying like, yeah, you can do that, you can't do that, you know, mm-hmm. like let's set some boundaries. And I wonder, are these sort of super blogs, I'll call them super blogs, but professional blogs run by large companies or large corporations, going to kind of change the field, kind of make us more responsible just because of the editorial oversight and because of the money involved? Or is it because it's the internet, are we never going to care about those things?
Some places, like, you know, Boing Boing, even though it's kind of, it's a blog and it's a big deal, I always get the sense it's still pretty quirky. The people writing for it definitely have their own perspective. But a place like The Toast, they push out so much content on a daily basis, and so much, I don't know how much editing they're actually doing apart from actually saying, yes, we will print this. The reason they're publishing articles is to get eyeballs in the ads, which is making them money.
To answer your question, Justin, I don't think that having more like lit journalism bleeding into the internet is actually going to result in more decorum. I think that it's, if anything, resulted in less because of clickbait, because of these models specifically, because of the jockeying for attention. I've often thought of the internet of 10 years ago or 15 years ago at this point. I tend to imagine as a space where there was a lot of distance between communities, where you could have that sort of personal blog and so on, or you could have a live journal, or you could have various things where in a really sort of natural and organic way, you found community of the people who you shared common interests with. or who you shared a similar outlook on life or something like that. And as a consequence of being among people whose interactions are governed by a kind of polite friendship, a loose friendship, or a deepening friendship, or whatever is happening as a consequence of the way that community is taking shape, that is less and less the case now when there isn't distance between communities. I mean, it used to be that, LJ is a ghost town now, but when LJ was really sort of thriving and I was on it, I'm still on there. My journal is locked now, as a consequence of the thing I'm talking about, but because it never used to be. You just used to be that I never encountered in my feed anything that was deeply horrible or offensive to my humanity or anything like that, purely as a consequence of the way that that community formed. But on the other hand, when you have something like Tumblr, the whole design of Tumblr is to expand constantly away from the source of whatever has created a thing, so that you're always exceeding the bounds of whatever your chosen community is, which means that there isn't any distance anymore between communities. Everyone is seeing everything constantly. And as a consequence, there's just this kind of really much more antagonistic baseline for the way in which people communicate. So
yes, I feel like completely.
Right. So, I'm not saying this in a bid for nostalgia or anything. It's just something that I've been observing and that it's been really interesting to me to observe, because it's also happening at the same time that more and more of our day-to-day lives are implicated with the internet or on the internet. Like it used to be 15 years ago, the internet was like an other world that I entered into and found my friends. It was an escape from reality in some ways. And it was literally a hyper reality. It was one where I found people who spoke the same language that I did in terms of what they read, what they enjoyed, all sorts of stuff like that, their general outlook. And now the world is on the internet. Everything is on the internet. Everyone is on the internet in some way or another. And the other world feels like whatever is removed from that. The other world is like, you know, a day when I don't go online is a day when I feel like I have sort of more fully experienced my environment. And it's a really strange shift. So I just feel like there's always going to be less decorum, because people are increasingly aware of how many people are watching them. And the nature of the internet as it's becoming is one of constantly entrenching and re-entrenching and re-entrenching positions. As someone said somewhere on a comics forum, that the internet rewards scorched earth arguments. And I feel like that's increasingly the case in a way that it didn't used to be 10 years ago. That the sort of most succinct expression of a given position and the less nuance it has and so on is the one that's going to be the most broadcast. All this to say, I just feel like, no, there's just going to be less decorum and more, ironically, as there is more and more awareness of how hyper-performative talking on the internet is.
Well, and you used to be able to, like, you know, in live journals, if you used to be able to sort of curate who you were having conversations with.
Yeah.
You know, you could curate your community. You could, you know, okay, this person can be on my friends list, or this person can be on this particular filter because to a certain extent that does produce like an echo chamber effect. But, you know, I belong to a closed group on Facebook mm-hmm. for a BBS that I used to belong to when I was in college, and I graduated from college in 1995. and so these are people I have known for over 20 years, and they are mm-hmm. my friends. And we all have, a lot of us have very different personal beliefs. And I think if we were all to meet now, we would not be friends.
I completely agree. Oh my God. One of my closest friends is a fundamentalist Christian who is, who for as long as I've known her has had political opinions that were absolutely opposite to mine. But we met in person in 2001. And developed a friendship around the things that we had in common. which were loads of things to do with literature and just kind of general behavior and all sorts of things. If I were to meet her on the internet, I would never have become friends with her. If I were to meet any of the things that she believes as expressions, as words on the internet, I would never have any interest in getting to know her as a person.
Well, some of these people, I mean, I've been friends with them for over 20 years and I've never met them in person.
Yeah.
You know, like the woman who's my accountant, I've known her for over 20 years and we just met in person just this last year for the first time. It's just like, I think, you know, it used to have more, just smaller, it was a separate world, which is a very, you know, dualistic view of things.
Mm-hmm.
And even now you get these things that people are like, well, you know, it's just the internet, just turn it off. But so many people's social lives are just so enmeshed in the internet, which is where I think some of the Gamergate stuff is so absolutely terrifying. Mm-hmm. It's because they are coming out of the computer at you.
There's a truism in politics that in political science that politics get radicalized in the diaspora, right? Mm-hmm. So the idea is basically that, you know, you get a lot more people in Irish pubs in Boston collecting for the IRA than you would in Ireland itself. Like, there is a sense in which those politics are radicalized. The same deal with Israel and Palestine. The politics about Israel in North America are much less nuanced than they actually are in Israel proper, etc. So there's a kind of polarizing and a radicalizing of opinion in the diaspora. And I feel like increasingly what's happening with the internet is that the more enmeshed our lives become with it in our day to day, every time we interact or write something on the internet, we are in some way becoming a diaspora unto ourselves, that like we are in a state of diaspora from ourself, literally, that whatever opinions we have as whole people outside of the internet, as soon as they are placed in the internet, become so thoroughly divorced from the context of us, of ourselves, that they are effectively in a state of diaspora, that you can only interact with other people's diasporic states in that way on the internet, so that it's no longer, you know, me and Natalie having a conversation and bringing to bear on the conversation the wholeness of our beings, you know, the things where we agree on things and the things where we disagree on things, and they all kind of share a common space. Instead, there is only that representation of an opinion that a person holds, and it's at so many removes from the person. It's not just the XKCD comic of, like, you know, bringing someone to face the person behind the screen that they're talking to or whatever. It's more than that. It's that you become focused into this one point, this one polarized diasporic representation of whatever it is that you think, and that becomes the whole of you on the internet. And it's a whole that is totally shorn of, you know, what you like to eat for breakfast, or, you know, what music you like, or, you know, the sense of humor that you have or whatever. It's just a representation. And it really freaks me out to see people having conversations at that level of discourse, because it's so limited and so completely divorced from anything resembling a normal human conversation. And yet it's becoming increasingly a new default. It's becoming a thing that is normal, that this is where the scorched earth argument comes in, where just you see people having conversations with a relentlessness and an anger that is appropriate to injustice, you know, to something terrible happening in the world. But instead, you're bringing that to bear on an instance of it, which is kind of like made into a synecdoche. It's supposed to stand in for all other instances of that injustice, but actually it is just an ignorant person.
You need to talk to the people at Cyborgology. It's a sociology blog. Sunny Moraine writes for them.
Oh, awesome. Okay.
And they talk a lot about digital dualism.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's an absolutely fascinating blog. A lot of it's completely over my head. Mm. I know one thing I've tried, like this, like last year was really hard for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's like, you know, this year I want to try to be kinder.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and in part that's because of this whole synecdoche thing you're talking about. You know, I don't want to just be somebody who goes on Twitter and is like, you're being a jerk.
There are tons of writers that I've interacted with at convention that I totally dislike on Twitter. But when I meet them in person, I'm like, oh, you're like a delightful human being. Like, I would love to spend some time with you.
Yes.
Or vice versa. Where in person, I'm like, you're a dick. But online, yeah, like, oh, you're terribly charming.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And I've like read characterizations of myself on the internet. And I'm just like, really? Wow. Because I'm like, well, that's not, I'm like, it's a thing. That's not how I perceive myself at all.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like, well, it's really interesting that that's how other people perceive me. And sometimes I'm like, okay, maybe I need to stop and think about this. Mm. Or sometimes it's like, you know, I'm going to consider the source.
Right. Absolutely.
This has been a fascinating conversation. I think we could probably do another show about this in the future after we listen to this and think of all the things that we didn't actually say that we wanted to say. So I want to thank you both for coming on. Fantastic.
It's been super fun. Thank you.
Thank you, Justin.
And this has been Rocket Talk.